Welcome everybody to the latest episode of the Mystery Crate. On this episode, I'm going to talk some country music with Jason Fitz, who's got legitimate Juilliard music chops. I knew Jason had a music background working with the band Perry in country music, but I had no idea he was classically trained and a very decorated music artist. So this was really fun. I wanted to have a conversation about country music and specifically alt country with Jason Fitz, because I think the whole genre finds itself in a very interesting moment in time. You have the emergence of this genre getting loads of critical acclaim, and you have country music sort of finding itself in a spot similar to NASCAR, which is all this social injustice is going on around it. The artists are starting to feel the need to speak up, and it's affecting them. So I think it makes for an interesting conversation, and I wanted to make sure that it was a base level conversation for a lot of people that don't know about alt country, so they can discover some new artists, and then we pry a little bit deeper. I really enjoyed getting to know Jason Fitz. He's a really good guy. Hopefully you enjoy our time here on the Mystery Crate that we shared with him. All right, we got an interesting Mystery Crate. I mean, that's easy for me to say because I'm interested in this, but maybe you won't be, maybe you will be. But I'm bringing on Jason Fitz. And Jason, we haven't really spoken outside of casual social media interaction, so I'm excited to actually get to know you. Here's what I know about Jason Fitz outside of his crazy work ethic, and there seems to be three of them. I'd also like to talk to him about the time on Outside the Lines in which his prompter went out or he tossed a sound and he was just staring blankly into a camera. Isolated, alone, hoping no one else saw that. Well, I saw it, Jason. I saw it.
Dude, that was, let me, I'm totally cutting you off, but let me tell you that that is one of the greatest moments for me because I learned something. If on OTL everything can go wrong, then it's fine. And you're right. I literally just finally looked at the camera and I said, you know what? We're going to try all this again after the commercial. That's the beauty of live TV. There was nothing else we could do at that point, but I'm reminded constantly if they can go that wrong for OTL, then it can go wrong for anything. That makes me feel good.
Jason Fitz, if you don't know, he has a country music background, played in the band Perry, amongst others. You were a touring musician. I'm sure you played with a lot of acts, right?
Yeah, and I played on a lot of studio sessions. So if I'll humble brag for a second, I have 13 Grammy nominations, one win, 40 million units in total sales. But I played on everything from Matchbox 20's Mad Season record to Alan Jackson records to Billy Gilman Christmas records. You know, it's like, it's weird. So I never got any of the gold records when I toured or platinum records when I toured, but I just went through the process of ordering them because now I'm far enough away from my music career. I want to look back with a little pride. So yeah, it was a hell of a run.
Actually. I mean, those are incredible bona fides, although your batting average in terms of like winning the actual awards, not so great.
Bad. Oh, yeah. It's bad. Yeah. No, I've got three Sports Emmy nominations so far, and everybody's like, you're going to get to the EGOT. And I'm like, no, I'm going to get to the nominee-got. That's my whole thing. Like, maybe someday.
The EGOT, none of the awards. I wanted to talk to Jason on the topic of one of my passions. Not a lot of people know this, but I'm really into country music. I like alternative country, which if you're not familiar with, is this sort of rock-based style of country music. And the stories they tell are a little bit better. Are a little bit different than what you're used to hearing on your country station on the radio that you hear, which is like pop country. I want to talk a little bit about that too with Jason Fitz because he goes all over the spectrum, but tell me a little bit about your music taste because I'm pretty eclectic myself. I like hip hop. I like indie rock. I like country. I like all country. Are you the same way?
Yeah. I mean, everybody says they listen to everything, but I genuinely listen to everything. Like my mom and dad grew up hating country music. So it was never on. The one exception was Kenny Rogers. My mom really liked Kenny Rogers, but my mom was into like 70s rock sort of stuff. So, and my dad was into like oldies and doo-wop. And then I grew up playing classical music. So by the time I was 8, I was practicing the classical violin 8 hours a day. So like that's all I was ever around was music. And when I say it's diverse for me, like I'm as happy listening to a Sinatra playlist as I am listening to a Tupac playlist. And that's sort of my life. I didn't really get into country. Like when I was a kid, I was big into, I'm 43. So I was big into hair metal bands. Like I remember my brother was 5 years older than me and he was into like the Depeche Modes and the Cure and all that stuff. And I didn't really get any of that, but I listened to it because I wanted to be cool with my brother. And I remember when Bon Jovi went Born to Be My Baby, the video came out and he was sitting there and he was just saying, this is such shit. This is terrible. Right. And I sat there and I was like, oh yeah, I hate it. But then I listened. And I was like, wait, I really think I like this. And so like I had this transformation where I became this massive. My first concert was Skid Row Bon Jovi. And I'll never forget Richie Sambora came out and he exploded on stage in what they call a toaster. It's this like platform that's under the stage and it blows you up and you lay, like you land. And I'm this classical musician at the time and I'm going to Juilliard and I look up and I'm like, man, that is so much cooler than anything I do. So like that was a transformative moment for me. So like that whole era was really big for me. But then I went to high school in a predominantly black and brown area of Prince George's County, PG County in Maryland. So I went to high school in an area where when Eazy-E died, like my high school shut down. So all of that really impacted me. But there was this key moment for me when I was actually studying with this prominent violin teacher in Chicago. And my roommate at the time came home one day and he'd thrown away all of my CDs and literally threw them away. And he's like, your music is trash and it all needs to change. And all he'd put down was a group of Aretha Franklin and Stevie Wonder records. So like that opened up the next chapter of my life. So all of these things were influences. And when, you know, I was singing with some guys and we got a record deal for RCA, we were going to do a pop project. We thought we were going to be huge and we lost our record deal. And at the time we were all listening, it's like the late '90s. We were all listening to like McGraw and Garth Brooks and we loved that version of country. So we moved to Nashville, not knowing anybody and just, we just moved down here and started singing for people on street corners, literally to try and get a record deal. And we did, and we kept getting signed and dropped and never made it. We never got famous. And then I started, like when I moved here, I played in the orchestra and I played in the studio orchestra, like, but that was my introduction into country. And I say all that because I didn't grow up. Like I remember the first time I did a cover country gig and somebody was like, I'll play Devil Went Down to Georgia. And I'm like, I don't know that song. Right. So like there was this late education period for me. But the way I started playing fiddle, which eventually led me to the band Perry, is I took old rock records and dissected them. So the first thing I ever played that wasn't classical music was I took Hotel California. I ripped it apart and figured out how to play both guitar parts at once on a fiddle. Like that was my goal, was to take iconic, you know, to me, iconic guitar solos and figure out their approach and use it as a fiddle player. So, I didn't grow up a big country roots guy. And even now I'm split sometimes. Like there are times that I appreciate pop country for what it is. And there are times that pop country just drives me crazy. So I literally am all over. That's a very long answer to a specific question, but
I appreciate it.
All over the place.
I appreciate it. Now I want to get into your country music career as a touring musician, as someone that was a studio musician as well, helping out all these other acts. I imagine your story is pretty commonplace. A bunch of people that had their dreams, had their own acts, got signed, got dropped, and they're just lifelong musicians that all have their stories of, man, I almost made it.
Oh yeah, like I remember the first artist that ever hired me outside of my bands was a guy named Phil Vassar, who in the late '90s, early 2000s had a ton of hits. And Phil is to this day one of the best people I've ever toured with, and one of the best human beings. But the crazy thing is, he knew at the time I was still looking at like I wanted to be an artist, and so he would sit down with me after shows and say, "Okay, here's how the money broke down. Here's what I got paid on. Here's how." Like he was a brilliant, brilliant guy. But the funniest thing to me was the very first, I was like on an audition, right? And the very first day up on the marker board at the front of the tour bus, it said 9 a.m. loaded. I woke up at 9:30. And so I'm running out like in my underwear on stage. And I'm like, I'm so sorry, I'm late. And all the crew guys are looking at me. They're like, what the hell are you doing out of bed? And I'm like, well, load in was at 9. And this is a first world thing to say. They're like, dude, you don't load in. We got people at this level that do that for you. And I'm like, I've never had anyone but me set up the speakers. I don't know what this is like. So yeah, there's this like moment that a lot of guys, and look, we're going to talk today about some different people, but like Isbell's another example of somebody that's been part of a million things and now he stands out and does his own. So yeah, there's definitely a moment where you wake up one day and you're like, man, I can't believe somebody else sets my, you know, by the time I left the band Perry, I was playing 6 or 7 instruments. And just the thought that somebody else set that up for me was like one of the most first world things. Every night I'd walk out and say, man, I'm the lucky one.
Well, you mentioned Jason Isbell, so let's start right there. To me, the top three American songwriters, singer-songwriters going right now are Frank Ocean, Father John Misty, and Jason Isbell, in no particular order. My first exposure to Jason Isbell was with the band Drive-By Truckers. I love country music so much because of the stories they tell. It's the best storytelling genre. Would you agree with that? I mean, hip-hop also tells a story, but the pictures that they paint sonically are just so vivid. That's sort of country music's thing. That's what it hangs its hat on.
Well, and that's to this day what they always say, you know, is that you've got to have a great song. And you know, for a lot of people that are breaking and trying to make it as writers, so many people write first and then transfer over and become artists. Like Kacey Musgraves is a great example of somebody that wrote for a lot of different people. And then when she suddenly became famous, everybody's like, of course. I mean, Kacey's been around town you know, writing songs with people for years. So, Maren Morris in that same, like, there's this group of people that were already friends that were making it as songwriters. But the reason so many of them carve out songwriting first is because there's this special skill to being able to tell a story that's intensely personal, but still relates to so many people. And I would argue that hip hop does that. Obviously, there's such a culture difference. I think it depends on where you came from, right? And I talked to a lot of different hip hop guys over the years, and I've had the opportunity to work a lot. With the band, we worked with a lot of different pop acts, and you know, it's funny how everybody approaches songwriting so differently. Like the Fall Out Boy guys are friends of mine, and the way they approach writing a song is, you know, can you get that hook? Can you get that melody? Like, can you get something that drives and feels like an ESPN song? Like, that's their mindset in so much.
Yeah,
you know?
It really does feel like Fall Out Boy had a couple of hits, and it might be a divisive band to throw out there, but it really feels lately that they're just putting out singles to get college football broadcasting rights to just play the crap out of their songs.
Oh, heck yeah. I mean, because you can make a ton of money doing that. Like, that's new. Like, it's like, hey, let's sit down and write an ESPN song, right? You know, but what a lot of people don't realize about Nashville for songwriting particularly, there's a real difference. Like, I almost signed a writing deal many years ago, and I decided instead to go play on the road. And what people don't realize is for pop country particularly, if I have a writing deal and you have a writing deal, we set up an appointment or someone sets up an appointment for us months in advance. We may not even know each other. And they're like, hey, you guys are going to write together on August 15th, and we're going to come in that day. We may never have met each other before. There's going to be a sheet on the wall that tells us who's about to cut records, like who's going in the studio. So it might say Luke Bryan, Florida Georgia Line, like all these things. You look up and then you start talking to somebody, and you'll spend a few hours chit-chatting. You'll go somewhere for lunch. You'll chit-chat a little bit more. And in about 3.5-4 hours in the afternoon, you will write front to back typically a song, and you're done with it. And then you do a little demo of it. You turn it in. You hope that my publishing company and your publishing company like it. They pitch it to artists. Artists decide to cut it. So like the ability to write a pop country song is absolutely a program skill. Because if I get together with a big writer, and I'll never forget, I learned this lesson from Tim Nichols, who he's got a few Grammys, wrote a ton of country songs in the early 2000s. And Tim was the one that said, man, if I don't know you and you come to an appointment and you didn't have any ideas, you didn't bring anything, you didn't have something in the kitty and we didn't write a song, I wasted a day of productivity. Cause when I write, you know, like I'm here. It's my job, you know? And so like, that's the main difference. Like pop country is approached from this very business. I know what makes a hit. You got to get to the chorus within 45 seconds. It has to be 3 minutes, 15 seconds long. Like it's formulaic. Guys like Isbell and, you know, and, Stapleton cuts a lot of stuff that's a little left of center to all of that too, yeah. Are more into the old 70s, 80s vibe of like, hey, I'm going to tell this story and whatever it is, it's less polished. And so you're still getting, it's different that way. It connects differently that way because by its nature, it's less polished.
What makes an alt country record to you? Because I hear certain pop country songs, right? And they sort of thematically hit on some of the notes that alt country does. Like Kacey Musgraves, she's got something to say, and she'll dive into some pretty dark stuff with her traditional top 40 country hits. Can you be a pop country artist like Stapleton, but also at your roots be an alt country artist that has that stuff to say? Like, how does Stapleton find a way to be a little bit more commercial than the likes of Tyler Childers or Jason Isbell?
Because Stapleton's just that damn good. And so I'll tell you, you're going to have to beep out a word in this. I'm sorry, but there's no way to tell this story without it. I was doing a Grammy Cares event, and they're fundraising events for the Grammys. I was still with the band Perry at the time. And it was honoring Lionel Richie. And a lot of people don't realize that Lionel Richie, at least several years ago, I don't know about now, but at one point he was the highest earning songwriter in ASCAP history. So he wrote We Are the World. I mean, for the love of God, the man wrote everything. But a lot of people forget he also wrote Lady, which is a huge Kenny Rogers song. And that was written for Lionel Richie, but then Kenny took it. So I'm at this Grammy Cares event. All these different artists are singing Lionel Richie songs. And so I got Little Big Town on one side of me, who are intensely talented vocalists. And I got Dave Grohl on the other side of me, and we all know who Dave is. And I'm standing there in between these two acts, and Stapleton gets up to just soundcheck Lady. And Dave Grohl looks over at me and says, this guy is a rock star. Now, when Dave Grohl says that, you have that it factor. And that's the reason Stapleton, I think, has crossed over, is because like he is at his core an alt country act. He's so stinking talented at everything he does, and everybody wants to work with him. But the transformative moment for him was when he did, obviously, the CMA Awards with Justin Timberlake. And what was lost in all of that was like Timberlake's wife and Stapleton's wife, they're good friends. So it was just sort of an accidental moment where he needed to do a duet and Timberlake was like, I'll do it. And it changed everything. So I think for just like pop country acts are always looking for a crossover hit in pop music, I think alt country acts every once in a while hit that crossover that lets them go into pop country.
Also, Stapleton, even, look, he's not the greatest showman, but compared to the likes of Jason Isbell, even Sturgill, he's probably the most showman-y of that group, and you have to have a bit of that rock star quality. And also, like, Isbell and Childers are talking about some pretty dark stuff, and I really don't ever see them crossing over. They're more apt to cross over on alt-rock than traditional country. Would you agree with that sentiment?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I had an entertainment attorney years ago that told me when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my career before I started playing for other people, I was really looking at one point I thought I might do the solo artist thing and I was trying to figure it out. And my buddy said, look, you got two routes you can go. On one side, you may or may not have creative control. People will tell you for the rest of your life what to wear, what to record and how to do it. And that's side A of this, but you're going to get to play all the big TV shows. You're going to play stadiums. You've got the shot to make it rich and be a household name. On the other side of it, you're going to load your stuff in a van and trailer for a very long time, and you're never going to have that household recognition. But you're going to be able to make a living, and you're really going to be able to, frankly, make the music you want to make. You got to make the decision now, the fork in the road, where you want to be. Isbell has made that decision, for example. A lot of the all-country guys have looked at it and said, yeah, I'm not interested in doing the same beach song over and over and over again. I'm interested in doing whatever I want to do. And by doing that, they've chosen to have essentially a smaller niche audience, not because they're not capable of more, but because they have substantially more control. And I don't think a lot of people realize, and I didn't realize until I got in the business, like you can have massive songs. You can have one of the highest selling songs of all time in country music, and you're still going to go to your label and your label is going to say, you know what? Here's your next single, whether you like it or not, whether you wrote it or not, this is what you're doing next. So I think guys like Isbell have decided that they're good taking the side over here. Stapleton is a little in the middle. Like Stapleton wants a little of both sides of it, and he's so talented, he's getting it. Casey's the same way. I think Casey is so just, her voice is so incredible, and everybody loves her so much that she's able to have a little bit more leverage.
And she's put in an interesting position, and it's not just being a woman, but it's having obviously more pop country appeal. I saw an interaction, and I want to talk about the responsibility, because this is on the front of everybody's mind, socially, what country artists have to do, because it's not unlike NASCAR a little bit. They understand their fan base, and they understand just venturing out into the political waters will be a divisive issue and cause some fans. I saw Casey Musgraves had this interaction with Jason Isbell on Twitter, and she asked, how many thousands of followers have you lost? And Jason said, Casey, I gotta be honest with you, I've gained thousands. And I found that dynamic super interesting, because they're saying the same things, I guess, because of her standing a little bit, or maybe she's just a little bit more careful, is playing it a little safer, yet she's suffering the promotional penalty a hell of a lot more than Jason Isbell. Why is that? Is it fairly obvious because Jason Isbell is this more critical darling? Even though Casey's got a bunch of critical acclaim, is it because she's letting people down, whereas those people that feel let down by Casey Musgraves weren't ever in on Jason Isbell to begin with?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of that. Like, Casey's fan base is a lot like a cake. Like, there's the critical element of it that is the icing on it, and then the majority of her cake has gotten very tall. It's a multi-layered cake with a lot of different fans. What's happened is when you expand like that and you have these fringe fans all over the place, it's those fringe fans that are going away. So you have to make a conscious decision, because you're right. I think one of the reasons that even on ESPN radio, I've resonated with the conversation around the Confederate flag and NASCAR is because, to be real, I've stood on stage at massive festivals with 50,000 people and looked out and seen 20 of them. And I've had the debate, you know, and I said this to somebody on air last week that was trying to debate me about my lack of understanding to what the Confederate flag means. Like, I've had that debate with smarter people than that caller was on tour buses time and time again. Like, I understand what it means culturally to an entire group of people that don't understand why culturally it means something else to other people. Like, you know, so for Casey, the minute you get into, I would say, like, this, the massive fair and festival season, and that's like the easiest way to describe it. When you can spend a summer playing Country Thunder in Arizona and then Country Thunder in Wisconsin. And then you're going to go play Stagecoach, which is on the same grounds as Coachella. It's just a week later. And you're playing all these, but you're playing these massive 50,000 people are in this one field festival. When you've gotten to that level, you have a lot of fans that have a certain set of beliefs. And the weirdest thing about country music fans in general is that they invest so hard into the acts that they, the first day I played for Phil, somebody came up afterwards and said, you're going to see me a lot. This is my 100 and something Phil Vassar show. And I'm like, you're kidding me, right? Like when I was with the band, I'll never forget, we were in Ireland and like we were walking up to the club that we were playing in Ireland, which was next door to the club. Imagine Dragons was playing the same night, right? And we walk up to the club and there were like half a dozen teenage girls that had seen our show like 40 times. And they took mom and dad's money and went to Ireland. Like country fans invest, right? And that's what makes it great. But the minute that you say something that doesn't align with what they think you should have said, it can get really hairy. And that's sort of the boat that Casey finds herself in.
An artist that I think finds himself in this position, and he seems sort of tortured just in interviews that you hear and types of music that he attempts, he experiments some for the genre that he's in, is Eric Church. I mean, when they came out with that song that Jason Aldean, Luke Bryan, and Eric Church were on, it was like the three horsemen of the new country apocalypse. You got to sort of pick one. It's sort of like Christina Aguilera or Britney. You're either right. Luke Bryan, Jason Aldean, or Eric Church. And it seems as though like Jason Aldean is sort of the middle ground. Eric's on one side of the spectrum, and then you have total pop megastar Luke Bryan, who's, to his credit, I've seen Luke Bryan in concert a bunch of times. Vocally, let's just say I took the under on the national anthem, but...
Oh, okay. It sounds like Gomer Pyle when he sings. Can we admit that? Like, it just sounds like Gomer Pyle.
Yeah, but he does a tiger purr, and he shakes the hips, and you get invested.
My ass looked that good in jeans. I did the same thing. I mean, come on.
Yeah. What position are they in? Because when I listen to Eric's music, he sort of seems frustrated by the situation he's in, because I know his aspirations, but he also has these mega hit country songs, these crossover hits. I mean, that Springsteen record was huge. What do you make of a position a guy like that is in?
Well, I think the thing for Eric, like, it reminds me a lot of conversations about athletes that get drafted later than they think. Like, basically, nobody wanted anything to do with Eric at the beginning. So he turned around and looked at Nashville and said, up yours. I'm going to do it my way. And he did it. And it's rare. It is rare to have an artist get out of the system and come up and make it, because Nashville is at its core a good old boy town. Like, it's, people always ask me, how do I get a record deal in Nashville? And my honest answer to that, whether you want a gig or a record deal, is you move to town and you start getting beers with people. Like, I don't think people realize, like for me, I never once got a recommendation for a gig. I never auditioned for a gig. Everything I ever got from a gig came from a recommendation from somebody that knew me, and many of them had never heard me play, but we were buddies and everybody says I'm good, so I must be good, right? Like, you got to be good to keep the seat, but it's a relationship town. And so Eric was never really fully, he never felt accepted. Then he went off and he built this whole thing that everybody fell in love with, but I think that chip is still on his shoulder. And then you start thinking about what it's like. Artists are just like athletes. They start looking around and they're like, well, why is this guy doing this? And we're not getting this. And why is this guy getting it? And it's like so many common stories you hear in Nashville are about artist A that has risen quickly, but he thinks he should be touring. You know, he should be headlining arenas and everybody wants him to be the support act. And wait, you're going to make me play 40 minutes on that set? I should get 45 minutes. And like, ego becomes such a big thing. And I think for Eric, because he never felt accepted, he's come into the entire system with the chip on his shoulder. And now whatever acceptance he gets, I'm still not sure that he feels in love with so much of the Nashville community. And so it's just like there's a weird divide for him. But I get it, because he wanted to do his thing. Everybody thought he couldn't. He did it. He was right. Like, he wants to come in and have everybody finally acknowledge, like, hey, you should be a superstar.
It also seems like he's kind of going out of his way, understanding the whole Chief persona, and he really blew up massively. And then for his next step, he comes out with Outsiders, and that is just a totally different direction sonically. And maybe a lot of those fans who are like, no, do Springsteen, were left a little disappointed. That seemed like a conscious decision on his part.
Sure. And that's the hard part. Like, I don't know Kenny Chesney. I won't pretend to know Kenny Chesney at all, but we have enough mutual friends. And one of our mutual friends said a couple of years ago, like, Kenny's as tired of doing beat songs as we are tired of hearing them. Right. And there's this moment where you realize at some point, like I said earlier, no matter how much success you have, there's a label that comes in and sort of dictates a lot of your direction. Now, some people want to fight to be free of that, but I would argue, especially in the male, so on the male side of it, you can describe most successful country acts by a character statement. So you can say, oh, He's the '80s rock country guy. Oh, that's Jason Aldean. He's the rock guitar playing country guy. Oh, that's Keith Urban. Oh, he's sort of the goofy country guy that plays the guitar. That's Brad Paisley. Like you can define each mega country star that we talk about in a, like he's the whiskey drinking country guy, Blake Shelton, right? So Eric Church never wanted to be defined by a sentence. And you can tell that by the way he puts out his records, but that's difficult for his audience who comes in. It's not just the label. It's the audience who comes in. It's like, well, I wanted another of the exact same thing. Like yeah. Records are put out so quickly and
put a drink in my hand. Put a drink in my hand, Eric. Where's the drink in my hand? But then the very next lead single is like, no, I'm an outsider, and you've let me into this club, but I don't really have much time. That's why I respect him. I kind of like Jason Isbell has cost himself a lot of money doing this. Yeah, it's good being Jason Isbell when there's alt rock fans and indie rock fans that lift him up as like, okay, this is my country music darling, but he's got the talent to be a crossover country artist. Jason Isbell has really cost himself a lot of money with this artistic decision. I have ultimate respect for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Isbell's play has been, he can do what he does, how he wants to do it, and he can do it for generations. And that's the other part of it. Like, you know, it's obviously, I was really lucky in the sense that I was able to leap off of the Ban Perry and, you know, come to another successful career at ESPN. A lot of people don't have an easy situation, you know, and so you start to look at what it means for acts that are huge commercially. They have to make compromise and they have to make decisions a lot of times. And then they have to accept, I've said this a million times. I've spent a lot of time on tour with Rascal Flatts over the course of the years. And I've become buddies with the guys. And we've talked about the fact that there's a roller coaster for every act in music. You have it up and you have it down. And so, like, there's two times, the joke is there's two times that you play the Indiana Fair. Like, you play it on the way up and you play it on the way down. And you like it a hell of a lot more on the way up than you do on the way down, right? So, for Isbell, what he's done is he's decided that all of that, like the fame and fortune and all of the things that you're right would probably be fairly accessible for him, would also require this trajectory. And it's a pretty steep up and down in pop country, as opposed to the way he can play it, where he can keep playing theaters and clubs like Christofferson. You know, like he can be that sort of a guy that goes out and does what he wants to do for a very long time. And I always go back to, like I mentioned Kenny Rogers earlier, before I was ever in anything that anybody had heard of, the band I was in opened for Kenny for several months, and smartest person I've ever been around when it came to the business. But one of the things that he, you know, said that always stuck in my head is he's like, man, when I left, because he was a huge rock guy, like he'd had massive success in rock music, right, in the 70s. And he's like, when I left, they told me I wasn't country, that I was too outside the box, I was too rock. And then they didn't like the song, so they said I was too pop. Along the way, I was too everything because I didn't come up the way that Nashville thought I should. Now I'm a Country Music Hall of Famer. And that's like the trajectory for so many people. Like, you got to decide if it's worth that fight.
Christofferson is such a good comp, especially with the Star Is Born stuff, because Isbell is such a transcendent songwriter that he's a made man. He doesn't have to put out a record of his own for the rest of his career and still make millions as a songwriter. You're saying he's playing theaters, and I've seen him in a couple of theaters and smaller venues. A guy that's playing arenas as this alt-country person is Sturgill Simpson, and he's really experimented, like concept albums type experiment. It also is pretty cool in this like arena tour that was postponed because of the pandemic. He was bringing along guys like Tyler Childers, sort of, hey, I know you're here for me because this is your fun little country guy experiment, but there are more people like me. What sort of responsibility does Sturgill Simpson have within the genre, and how is he viewed within the industry?
Everybody loves Sturgill. I think you're right. I think the best way I could say it is he's fearless in the way he puts out music. And it's funny because I think Sturgill is a living, breathing example of somebody that's had tremendous success that 80% of the people, maybe 70% of the people that love his genre don't even know who he is, right? Like Sturgill Simpson is somebody that is having the highest level of success, making music exactly the way he wants to make. I think in 30 or 40 years, he'll be part of the way the story of current country is actually told. And so many pop country fans right now couldn't tell you a song, right? So it's a weird divide, but he doesn't give a damn. And so does he have a responsibility? I think, yeah, obviously once you reach that level, it's about, you know, helping your buddies, right? For a lot of these decisions, who opens on tours, and like people don't realize that if it's just a one-off and you're playing a show, nobody really makes that decision. Like sometimes the venue makes that decision. Sometimes you never talk to them at all. But if it's a long tour, it's management and the label and the booking agent. They all get involved in these conversations about who helps you sell tickets, or who do you want to help give exposure to? And for somebody like Sturgill, he doesn't need help selling anything, right? So he then becomes the help selling somebody else. So I think there's a huge opportunity, and with that obligation to try and help grow what they're doing. You know, if you want to be outside the box, that's the best way to do it.
You mentioned where country music is headed and how Sturgill might be at the head of that. Given everything that's going on across the world, really, has that been fast-tracked a little bit? Is there a reconciling country music fans have to do and the artists have to do to realize we can't keep our mouths shut? We can't be complicit right now. We understand our fan base, but we have to move this thing forward. Do you think it's going to have a bit more edge to it going forward?
I think all country is going to, in general, have a huge different edge to what's being written over the next couple of years. Pop country? Now, unfortunately, I mean, look at the blowback Lady Antebellum got for changing their name to Lady A. Now, it's not a daring change, to be honest. Everybody's called them Lady A from the day they came out. But they came out and made a statement that, hey, we're not proud of what Antebellum means, and so we're not proud of what we've been a part of, and we don't have a good answer for why it took so long, but we're going to fix this. Now, I thought it was a really transparent, honest moment, and, you know, they got crushed by a lot of that fringe and very loud country music fan. And again, I think that there's a similarity. Like, fandom is defined by its lowest common denominator, like it or not. Like, I'm a Raiders fan, and when people hear that, they immediately presume that means I'm, you know, a certain way. And obviously, like, I'm not, like, as a guy, I'm just not that person. I believe that there are more good NASCAR fans than there are bad NASCAR fans. But right now, what we're talking about around NASCAR is about the Confederate flag and the flying of it. Country music is the same way. I believe there are, we noticed it when I was still touring. You know, you have the same 30 minutes before, you have the same pre-roll every night. So you give your front of house guy songs that you think are going to pump the crowd up or get the crowd in the right mood for the show. And I'll never forget, over the last two tours, we would sit on the side of the stage and we'd watch the pre-roll music. And Bruno Mars was getting as much pop from that crowd as Luke Bryan was, as any country was. And we had this awakening moment. We're like, wait, we should make our pre-roll as diverse as possible, because we want our show to be as diverse as possible, because we at the time, I was part of a pop country group that had a pop crossover. So we understood that our audience was had a bigger range in what they were listening to. But it's funny, you know, I think a lot of people forget that. And so for country music, there's got to be this movement forward. I just don't know that enough acts are willing to take the risk that it would take at the highest possible level to risk their fans. And that's unfortunate, because there's a huge platform there.
Yeah. And I'm not sure enough fans are willing to say, okay, here too. Many, I think a lot of those fans are just going there for an escape. Look, I'm getting it everywhere. That's why you're seeing the pushback on NASCAR. No, I thought I could be myself here. No, I thought I didn't have to worry about that here. And I think for many country music fans, that's also a similar place, which is, I'm not getting that here, man. I'm not coming here for that. I'm coming here because it could all be a kept secret amongst ourselves, and we could all be like-minded.
And the unfortunate part, because you're right, and the unfortunate part about that is there are a couple of givens you know you can do in a country show. And I'm not throwing my industry under the bus. I'm just saying, if you go to any country show in the middle of the summer, you know at some point they're going to thank the military. They're going to say something about our country. Yeah. They're going to, these are just in these are woven things in the fabric. And, you know, we had a moment in when we were touring where every night we played the national anthem going into one of the songs. And it was a moment of saying thank you to everybody that, you know, is better, braver, and more courageous than we are, that have fought for our freedom, something that I believe in. But you can also then have the other side of this entire conversation. So for any country music fan that says not here, I would ask, is the show not already at some level politicized? It's just politicized in a way that you're comfortable with. And that's one of the awful things about it, because, you know, I had a real, and this didn't get aired, unfortunately, because there was just no good spot for it. But before the NFL draft in Nashville, I sat down with a bunch of different country artists and we did these interviews, vignettes that were played in the draft. And one of the interviews that we did that I was proudest of was talking to Darius Rucker. And Darius flat out admitted that when he came out, and he would admit this, and I'm sure he has in other interviews, but he flat out admitted that when he came out, there were programming directors that didn't want to play his music because he's black. And there was a concept that fans weren't going to support an African-American making country music. And he broke through that wall, and Darius got emotional. But the cool thing to me was that an hour later, my next interview happened to be with Jimmy Allen, who is somebody that has had a good success. And as I talked to Jimmy and we were just talking about it, he was turning around saying, hey, like, it's different now. And then I talked to Kane Brown. And when I talked to Kane Brown, Kane was like, dude, and they aired all the Kane stuff. And, you know, I asked him how different it is now. And he's like, man, Darius paved the way. And like, there has to be an acknowledgement that music needs to be more varied, and country can look around and say, man, instead of shutting these things down, if I'm a country fan, I'm proud of where the genre has come in the last few years, but I also acknowledge how many more steps that need to go.
He's Jason Fitz. He's the host of First Take, Your Take, and let's be honest, about a dozen other things. There was, I mean, pre-pandemic, I was getting a little worried about Jason all across the digital projects and traditional front of camera stuff. Jason's been a real key contributor to what ESPN is doing, and he's fantastic at it. And as you know, he's fascinating. I mean, we're talking about Juilliard Bonafide, so that's crazy. And I want to do an entire pod just talking about Matchbox 20. So we're going to have
Rob Thomas, great guy, by the way. Great. Rob Thomas is a great just the coolest hang, by the way. Yeah. And check out the Mad Season record. There's a hidden track at the end of Mad Season on the last song. If you wait like 4 minutes after, like they used to do, you know, when I'm old, if you wait like 4 minutes after, there's a solo section there that's just the orchestra from the last song. It's one of the coolest orchestra tracks I ever played on. So you should check out the hidden track at the end of Mad Season.
All right. Easter egg for our audience. Jason, good getting to know you. I appreciate you taking the time out to join us here on Mystery Crate and having this discussion with me.
Man, it's a blast. Thanks for having me. Anytime, you know, I'm happy to come on and talk, especially music. I love talking about it.
All right. We'll do that again. I'll take you up on that. Jason, take care, man.
Thanks, brother.
That'll do it for us this week. Thanks to Jason Fitz for finding some time available in his schedule, because that dude is super busy, probably busier than anyone in this company outside of Stephen A. Smith. Loved getting to know him. Hope to have more music conversations with him and others around ESPN. Let me know what you think. Hit me up on my personal Twitter account at Michael Ryan Ruiz. Let us know what you think of Mystery Crate. Go back into our archives. I'm really enjoying the dad pod that Chris and Roy Bellamy are doing. So make sure to check that out. It's where they catch up with other ESPNers and talk about parenting. That'll be our episode this week. We will talk to you next week. Thanks again.
Did you know Geico's now offering an extra 15% credit on car and motorcycle policies? That's 15% on top of what Geico could already save you. So what are you waiting for? Your teenager to help around the house?
Okay, Mom, I emptied the dishwasher, vacuumed the basement, and folded the sheets out of the dryer.
Wait, what?
Oh, and next, I'm going to clean Mitten's litter box.
Are we in some kind of prank show or something? That's a camera, isn't it?
There's never been a better time to switch to Geico. Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Limitations apply. Visit geico.com for details.